So this morning, we're going to be talking a little bit about anxiety, which I think is almost humorous, contextually, but not a funny thing. I want to say a bit more about what I mean by that word in this context and why I want to explore it in a moment, but I wanted to get a couple of misconceptions out of the way right off the top. I should say at the outset that this exploration is not meant to displace or supplant any kind of clinical or therapeutic care process. This is not that. I am not a mental health expert or clinician, and I'm not going to pretend to be. I'm a slightly outside of the box pastor, and so these thoughts come too kind. I actually thought about that phrase when I wrote it. Clearly not quite enough. Okay, outside of the box. We'll take off the adjective. So the thoughts come from that perspective, and you know, unapologetically from that perspective. So for me, that means this is an issue that I feel like I see in the culture and the community around me, and I think that one potentially helpful lens we might use to kind of look in on it is the wisdom of Jesus. And so we're sort of picking up this not bare minimum Jesus series again after kind of stepping away from it over Christmas and New Year's. And I should also say, and this is probably most relevant for people that are listening to this as a podcast that aren't normally a part of or frequently a part of the gatherings, that you should not expect from me any sort of kind of magical talk about healing as a part of this. And I put magical and healing together because healing's a big word, so is magical. My objection is neither to the ideas that we might use a word like magic for, nor to the ideas that we might use in a conversation about healing. It's when we put them together and put them under the umbrella of religion that I think we have a problem. And so that's kind of not what's going to happen. And the bigger context for that, for me, is that this whole loose collection of not bare minimum Jesus explorations that we started last year, I wanted my vantage point in that to be the vantage point of seeking the kind of wisdom in the teachings of Jesus that you could apply to your life no matter what you think about Jesus. Because who Jesus is and what we think or what we think about when we think about who Jesus is and what that means, huge gamut, right? Huge, huge gamut. And even in a community like this, I assume a huge gamut. So I am not coming from the vantage point of here's the one way, kind of right way to think about who Jesus is. And I want to approach these things in such a way that there's a bare minimum of barriers to plugging them in to life. And if you grew up around, for example, the idea that Jesus is divine, the Son of God, born of sort of, again, sort of magically of a virgin and so on and so forth, if that's kind of the idea set that you grew up with, it can be super hard work to think about the wisdom of Jesus aside from that. But it's actually accessible aside from that. So more on that in a moment. But let me just put it into another sort of phrase. I want to try to approach the wisdom of Jesus in this series of reflections such that you don't have to be some kind of believer to recognize wisdom when you see it, and you don't have to be an adherent to any particular religion to apply it. So that's kind of where I'm trying to come from in these reflections. Having said that, I don't think that believing particular things about Jesus that are unique to religion, most obviously to the religion of Christianity, I don't think that will necessarily get in the way of applying the wisdom of Jesus to our lives. So there's a backwards thing for a pastor to say, right? But nevertheless, I say it because I think it might get in the way if our religion encourages us to think of Jesus as sort of some kind of cosmic magician or Santa Claus, sort of the kind of being that zaps us into being different kinds of people. And the reason I think that might be a problem is to sort of state it really baldly and obviously, if we're sitting around waiting to get magically changed as people, that probably means we're not taking responsibility for our own change process, and we're not getting to work on what we can do in the here and now, because we're just parked waiting to get zapped. So that's where certain religious conceptions of Jesus and how the Jesus idea operates can really be a problem when it comes to growing as people or plugging wisdom into our lives as people. So I hope that sounds reasonable, because again, I want to reduce the barriers. Think what you will, but I want the entry point to be as barrier-free as possible for these ideas. So with that in mind, when it comes to the matter of anxiety, what motivates me to explore it? Why would I care about this personally? And probably one of the main reasons for that is a personal one.
comes from personal experience. Taya, who's here this morning, and by the way, Taya has seen these notes, and they are Taya approved, just so you know. Taya's a dancer, and every week, Taya spends a good chunk of her time dancing in several different disciplines with a variety of instructors and a group of young women who are about the same sort of age and stage as her. And that all takes place in a setting that I would say is a uniquely balanced one, particularly for a dance studio. From my vantage point as a dance parent, the world of dance might produce some remarkably strong bodies, but it's not necessarily a world that fosters overall health in its dancers, in its artists. And I'm really delighted that the studio where Taya dances makes a concerted effort to combat some of the obvious imbalances that dancers might be prone to and that the dance culture wrestles with, and it works hard to care for the minds and the spirits as well as the bodies of the participants. I'm really grateful for that. In general terms, Taya's fellow dancers are not people that live on the margins of society. There are some exceptions in that setting, but in the main, I think that's a fair statement. They come from caring homes, their basic needs are well met, they have nurturing people in their lives. You could say that the stuff at the bottom of the pyramid of their experience, if we're using like a hierarchy of needs sort of image, is in pretty good shape. And yet, when I pick Taya up from her dance class and we talk about her day on the drive home, it's not unusual for her to talk about being surrounded by young women that are struggling with anxiety. They're having anxiety attacks in class, and they're having their kind of core functionality impacted by this issue in ongoing ways. And for a while, I wrestled with how much this was about kind of the ways that therapeutic language is just becoming so common in our culture that we're starting to use it for things that aren't diagnosable, technically speaking. So for instance, the language of depression, and there's some good things about this as well, but I'm going to critique it just a little. The language of depression has become common enough in our culture that if we feel sad, we might say, I'm depressed. Well, that word means more than one thing, and some of the meanings are clinical, right? But the language has become common. If I feel stressed out about something, I might say I struggle with anxiety. So that sort of thing around the language of a mental health. So I was kind of like, is that just what's going on here? Is the language of anxiety just bleeding into sort of the normal adolescent ups and downs and getting applied to those experiences in that setting? So I kind of wrestled with that for a bit. And then this all sort of felt like, and again, Taya gave me permission to say this way, it felt like that was starting to impact her in ways that I was concerned about. So I thought, well, I should do some more homework, right? I should educate myself about this some more, which brought me to the second reason that I wanted to explore this with us as a community. As it turns out, once again, science proving the obvious, the statistics are pretty consistent with the experiences. We are an anxious culture. According to the Canadian Community Mental Health Survey results that were released in 2013 in this country, anxiety is the most common mental illness in Canada. And as the current stats suggest, over the course of our lifetime, 1 in 4 of us will suffer from at least one anxiety disorder. That's where the I'm not anxious, I'm struggling with anxiety line gets crossed in terms of the way the survey is using the language. Anxiety disorder is not I feel anxious. Right? It's clinical definition. And not surprisingly, I think, the most vulnerable group are youth aged 15 to 24, which from a personal vantage point at this moment in our family's life means that every person in our family, every child in our family is in that vulnerable group age-wise. And Taya's like got a bullseye painted on her in terms of that group, you know? So that Taya and her fellow dancers are like they're the hub of that wheel statistically. I'm intrigued but not surprised that despite the prevalence of the challenge, despite the fact that this is so common in our culture, when people are asked to cite the main barrier to seeking help, the predominant answer is still stigmatization. the main reason why someone wouldn't step forward and say, I'm struggling with this, I need some help, is still, what might other people think? With that in mind, I find myself feeling grateful that Taya and her dancers are in an environment where they don't feel that they need to hide it if they're struggling. How lovely. They're free to share their struggles with one another, with their instructors, with other support staff, with the studio. That's good. But in very general terms, those are the kind of experiences and kind of information that kind of made me think, no, this is worthwhile. We should explore this a little bit. They're not in the target group, what can I say? That sounds like a different emotional experience happening in there to me right at the moment, doesn't it? I'm not saying small children don't struggle with it. Jesus, of course, since this is about the wisdom of Jesus, didn't talk about anxiety as a mental health condition, right? And like any number of other things that we experience and have language for that we don't find in the language of Jesus. And if we come at any ancient wisdom story looking for those kind of correlations, like we're just going to be out of luck when it comes to drawing on ancient wisdom. It's just not going to happen because that's not kind of the frame. So if we want to actually draw on ancient wisdom, whether it's the wisdom of Jesus or from some other source, then one of the things we have to do is we have to come at it with kind of a couple of our faculties in high gear. One is our imagination, because we're interpreting. We talked the other week about making our way through the real world based on a map. This is sort of like that. We're moving from text of an ancient story that's far distant from us culturally to a contemporary experience. That requires imagination. And the other thing that it requires is empathy. And if you can hook those two together, ancient wisdom starts to come alive. And we have lots of room. Jason touched on this already. We have lots of room, lots of permission to do that. And it's necessary if we actually want to draw on ancient wisdom. So, what we're not going to get from Jesus is, when you struggle with anxiety, therefore, thou shalt do this, right? Like, that's not the way this works. But there's these human experiences that are available to us that are redolent with wisdom that has something to say to our contemporary experiences of these things. If you grew up around the Jesus stories being considered primarily religious narratives, and lots of us in this room did, this is going to be a little bit of a challenge. last week, for instance, I was exploring this story about Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, and someone in the community came up to me afterwards to say that the perspective that we considered was one they hadn't encountered before. Thank you. Like I said, a little bit outside the box. But their experience was that when I said what story I was going to consider, what happened for them is that all of the other takes that they've heard on this story over the years just kind of came flooding into their imagination, right? So it's kind of a crowded space when that happens. There's all these other versions of what does this mean that just kind of come rolling in, unbidden. They're in there, and we just woke them up. So when you try to come at a story that you've encountered that way, in a different way, that can be really like hard work. So it's okay if that's hard work. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens for a few of us this morning as well, because the story that I want to look at has had to haul lots of religious freight over the years. And we've probably all heard different takes on it. At the beginning of this particular story, Jesus is not having a great week. His mentor, John the Baptist, someone that he's clearly, based on the gospel stories, cares for.
His second cousin.
That's right. Yeah, close to in other ways in that culture, has just died, and he didn't like get in a car crash. I mean, he got beheaded, as it turns out, for a reason that was no more substantial than the whim of the daughter of the wife of the person who held the most power in the kingdom, King Herod. It was a party trick. It's easy to, in an old story like this, it's easy to kind of dismiss or deflect the brutality of this, but we need to not do that. We all know by our own experience what kind of press it gets when a group anywhere in the world beheads a person these days. That is an egregiously brutal way for someone to be killed. It is now, and it was then. It's a trauma. for everyone that's connected to it. And so this is what Jesus has just experienced. Jesus is you in this story. I don't know how else to say that. Just strip off all the other stuff. You just got the text. You just got the phone call. So what Jesus needs is what any of us would need. Jesus needs some solitude. Jesus needs some time and some space to grieve and to process. And if you want to add what we might think of as a more benign but I think still significant layer, consider that Jesus would have been regarded not just as a relation of John's, a relative, but also as an associate. And if you've ever had that experience of, you know, the person in the next office just got laid off, and you wonder if you're next, this is that experience like on rocket fuel. Because the person in the next office didn't get laid off, they got beheaded. Bad week. So Jesus tries to get what he needs by taking a boat to what he hopes will be a secluded location. But that's not what happens. What happens is that the people who are intrigued by what he's doing in the culture, what he's saying, they find out where he is. And they walk there. And they're very determined to be where he is. And they show up, and they keep showing up, and more of them show up. And there's this huge crowd. And the solitude and the space to grieve and to process are not what is happening. And so by supper time, there's thousands of them. No matter how elastic we regard the numbers as being, there's a bunch of people. And so Jesus kind of shifts gears. And instead of the solitude and the process, time and space, he does what he does. He does what brought them there in the first place. He starts to talk about the ideas that he's been talking about. He starts to contact people and care for them. He starts to give of himself. He does what he's been doing. Jesus is the rabbi in this situation, and I don't think any of us in this room would sort of have any significant sense of cultural connection to how profoundly important the rabbi would have been culturally. But he's the reason that the people are there as a teacher. And so he's the person that the disciples, who are looking at the crowd and going, this is a lot of people, and it's been a long day, and how are we going to feed them? Because they came because of you, because of us, so we're responsible. And we just get an inventory, and there's not a lot to work with. There's like one kid who's owning up to having some food along. They come to Jesus with their anxiety on 11. How are we going to solve this? Tim Penner, do we cancel? Because this morning's small crisis, right? What do we do? How do we solve the problem? We have a problem. And, hand-wringing ensues. And Jesus, well, this is interesting because Jesus really doesn't answer the what's the solution question. But he does do some things that are really instructive. And the first thing that he does is he gives the anxious disciples something to do. This is intriguing. He empowers them to do something. And he empowers them to do something that they might have experienced as empowering. It doesn't make the stressor go away, but it starts to shift something. And so what he does is he says, get everybody seated. Well, this isn't like, turn up the PA, sit down. Like a hillside full of people. Like they got to get their hands on it. They got to go do it. They have to be in contact with people. They have to engage. My dad would have said something like, at a moment like this, like, make yourself useful. Like, actually, I'm quoting, I'm not interpreting. Make yourself useful, look around for what can be done, and do that. I remember being a 12-year-old on my dad's construction site. He was a contractor, and having him say that to me and looking around the construction site and going, yeah, but I don't know what that means in this setting. And then him saying to me, well, clearly my kid needs more direction. Tim, every board that's shorter than this needs to go in that bin. Go. And that kept me busy for half a day. It's that kind of job in some ways, right? Now, I don't know about you, but if I kind of try to bring some empathy and some imagination to this from the disciples' vantage point, I can feel the why bother vibes like coming off the disciples, right? That's how it reads to me. Like, seriously? Like, why are we doing this? Jesus, the people are, it's all in the emphasis. The people are starving, right? And you want me to rearrange the seating? Like, come on, we got a problem here. I hate it when there's a crisis brewing and somebody just gave me busy work. I can feel that vibe coming off here a little bit. I'm speculating, of course, aren't we all? But as I imagine it, what Jesus is doing is dialing it down a bit. And that's not a bad idea when it comes to handling anxiety. It's also not a bad idea to find something to do rather than sort of pacing in circles either inside or outside of our head. And if that involves engagement with other people, also not such a bad idea, potentially. Another way to look at this part of the story is that the disciples have been asked by Jesus to do the sort of work that lots of us feel like we do every day. By which I mean, they have been asked to do something purposeful, but partial. Right? For them, the presenting problem is there's a bunch of people here that need to be fed. That's the crisis. That's what's got them wringing their hands. And Jesus says, have everybody sit down. He didn't answer the question they were asking, which is, where's the food going to come from, right? It's partial. But it's purposeful. It's actually an engagement in the surrounding experience of the things that surround the issue. So they're actually working on the problem. They don't actually know how much they're working on the problem just yet. That unfolds later in the story. But that experience of, I've got something I could do, but it really doesn't feel like it's going to make the thing that's making my alarm go ding, ding, ding. It's not going to make it go away. So why bother? That intersection is an intersection where Jesus, in his wisdom, engages his anxious disciples. He gives them something purposeful but partial to do. But it's this next part that really grabs me. And this is the part where I think it's going to be hardest for some of us to hear through the static. Because this is the part that many of us have been told over and over again is all about something from nothing. It's all about, this is the miracle part, right? This is usually the hinge that the story turns on. But just for a minute, I want us to try to hear this part of the story sort of stripped of all of that religious trapping. What Jesus does next, and all the gospel writers tell this part of the story more or less the same, what Jesus does next is he takes what he has and he expresses gratitude for it. He does it overtly, he does it publicly. His disciples already got everybody else sitting down. Presumably they succeeded in the task they were given. So the focal point of this entire moment in the story is the expression of gratitude for what is already there. That's fascinating to me. I mean, really, everybody on the hillside, as we're told the story, is hungry. Everybody on the hillside can see this action, this expression of gratitude. And they're thinking, I don't know, like, what are they thinking? Mm-hmm. What does this look like? What does this feel like? If we can set aside the interpretation of this story as a conjuring story, as a making something out of nothing story, a story that validates Jesus as an alien, or that validates Jesus as a divine being that can magically make food for people that don't have food, or a being that can give power to people that don't have power, or a being that can lead a military uprising and overthrow Rome. If we can sort of strip those interpretations of this moment off the story and suspend them in our head for a minute, what do we have left? Well, depending how steeped we are in those other versions of the story, we might just instinctively say, we've got nothing left. But we do. And in the simplest version of, that I'm aware of how to read this story without all of those interpretations hung on it, what happens here is Jesus is saying, there's enough to go around, it'll be all right. There's enough to go around, it'll be all right. If you ask a 21st century therapist, or actually just a 21st century thoughtful person, where does our anxiety usually come from? The answer will often have something to do with perceived scarcity. We're anxious when our perception of the world is that there isn't enough of something that we believe we need or that we want to get our part of. That's often the root of anxiety. There's only a finite amount of opportunity. There's only a finite amount of resources. There's only so much accomplishment to go around. So your success diminishes the chances of my success. There's only so much available praise. There's only so many available possessions. There's only so many chances to get ahead. Whatever the thing is that we view as limited or scarce, that's the thing that can promote our feeling anxious about it, right? So, it's not hard to see, if you just sort of rough it out like that, how that's a debilitating habit of mind. Whether we think about this in personal terms or professional terms, because it's a really short step from seeing the world that way to finding it very difficult not to turn a potential collaborator into a competitor. It's very difficult from the mindset of scarcity to not turn a potential friend into a potential rival, for instance. And it's really hard from the perspective of scarcity to feel good about our own accomplishments, because no matter how good we're doing, someone else is always doing better. As a parent, I've wrestled with how to send this message to my kids, how to say, you are awesome, and you know there's a bunch of people out there that could kick your ass, right? Like, and that's okay. Like, you get that those things can coexist and it's good, like it's all right. This, and it's never not going to be that way. Like, ever. That's all right. That does not mean that we need to think about that moment or that experience in our life as something diminished. Think about it that way is like just tossing the fertilizer on the anxiety plant, you know? So what might Jesus be up to, given those kind of ideas, with this whole sit down and watch while I express some gratitude thing? Because that's basically what the theater is here. That's what happens in the drama. Here's one possibility. Just another lens. Maybe Jesus is pointing away from scarcity toward its opposite, which is abundance. Maybe that's what the little theater piece is about. And the reason I think that that's a possibility in this story is because I've seen what grows out of seeing the world as a place of enough rather than a place of not enough. And what grows from that perspective is gratitude. And what grows from gratitude is generosity. That's the way that works. We know that by our own experience. And by the way, this is not a sneaky aside about talking about giving to the table. You've heard that sermon. I hope not here, but you've heard it somewhere. I guarantee you. You've been in church, right? This is where we say, oh yeah, and so if you give to the church, you know, you'll get rich. Anyway, not that I'm not that guy, and this is not that church. In the mental picture, this mental picture in our imagination, because it's the only way we can access the story, our mental picture of this story is like Jesus kind of ripping piece of, after piece of bread off the same little loaf and handing it out till 5,000 people have more than enough. Lots of us have heard that version. If that version of the story stirs skepticism for you, and it might, then here's another way to think about this whole question and this whole story. Have you ever watched the ripple of generosity run through a community? Like, are you aware of a Kickstarter story where people responded to a crisis and you just went, really, that much? Like, we've all heard that story, right? Ever been to one of our community potlucks if you want a small local, you know what I mean? Listen, gratitude is the ground that generosity grows in. And I think Jesus knows it. And I think the weed that gets choked when generosity grows in the ground of gratitude, I think the thing that finds it difficult to thrive in the same space is anxiety. This is not magic. This is not a binary. This is a complex process. Personally, so now the lens is just the size of Tim's perception on this, and then we'll rescue Ariel. Personally, when I think of this story, I think that if it has any basis in fact at all, I can't find it in me to believe that one person in this symbolic crowd of 5,000 brought lunch. Furthermore, I can't find it in me to believe that that one person, should that be a material fact, would be a kid. Except if the storyteller wanted to egregiously make the point. Because the kid in this culture is the person who has no particular power. Children were less valuable than livestock in this culture. A kid, one kid in a crowd of 5,000, remembered to bring some food along when they went out the door. Far more credible version to me of what's going on in this story is that it's a kid that stepped up.
He's the only one willing.
Or maybe naive, or maybe whatever, right? There's lots of ways to read that. But it would be a kid with no power who's like, yeah, I got some food. When the disciples came around to do inventory, he's the one person in the whole crowd who's not thinking, I know I've got something in my pack, but if I speak up about it, I'm making a choice between something endangering to myself, because everybody's going to want my lunch, or just absolutely futile, because what difference is it going to make? Ever been there with a resource? Ever been there with time? Ever been there with energy? Ever been there with anything that you could share? I've been there, right? There's no way I'm going to step up with this. I'd be embarrassed. Whatever. We can think of a reason. But the kid doesn't think of any of those reasons in this story. They step up with that thing. For me, the way this story works the very best in my imagination is when the kid does that, the adult next to them goes, oh, geez. Right? And then the adult behind them goes, oh, okay, now it's a movement. Now it's a Kickstarter campaign. Now I better jump on. Whatever. And at the end, what happens in the story is that the disciples have to clean up because there's leftover food on the ground. And if that's not a story about abundance, like, I don't know what, right? To me, that's a fascinating way to read the story about Jesus' wisdom about anxiety. What am I grateful for? What does this have to do with that? My anxiety is 5,000 hungry people ravening in my soul. My resource is a piece of bread and a couple of fish. Like, what I'm grateful for feels like it has nothing to do with that. But it does. Gratitude is the ground that generosity grows in, and anxiety finds it hard to grow alongside generosity. I'm going to leave it there for all sorts of reasons. One of them is that could all seem too Pollyanna-ish, too it's all good, it's all sunshine, and I get that. Jesus' wisdom about this keeps going. It doesn't reside just in this story, and we're going to keep exploring it a little bit more. I don't know if that'll be 1 week or two, but we'll kind of keep digging into it a little bit because there's more there to probe. But where I'm going to leave it this morning is just with this thought, that if we're struggling with anxiety, whether that's just we feel anxious about something or whether that's the thing that we would give a clinical name to because it's a collection of symptoms and experiences that add up to a diagnosable condition. Wherever on that spectrum of experiences we might be, it's worth considering what the possible relationship between gratitude and anxiety might be, and whether there just might be something there that should be cultivated in our lives. All right. Peace.